Hello and welcome to the fifth season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb and we're back with brand new weekly episodes where I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. Since announcing this season on social media, I've had a lot of really nice comments from listeners and all your feedback is always appreciated. So if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week comes from a family that have been dairy farmers in Somerset for generations. Rich Clothier is the managing director of Wyke Farms and has been a key part in taking this family business from local producer to one of the largest independent cheesemakers in the UK, producing over 16,000 tonnes of cheddar per year to the same 160-year-old recipe. What's more, Rich has overseen the long-term strategy to make farming and production more sustainable at Wyke, with a mission to be a net positive business. We met back in January of this year and talked about a really wide range of topics that are at the front of mind in rural and agricultural life. So I hope you enjoy this fascinating chat. Rich, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Lewis.
How are you? How's the start of the year been? We're in January, a couple of weeks in. How's the start of the year been for you?
We're busy. So I always say if you're busy, then really you've got nothing to moan about. But it's been such a challenging 3 or 4 years with Brexit, COVID and all the other stuff. We're sort of looking at the year ahead, hoping that things will get a bit more stable and we can just concentrate on running the business and trying to grow and, you know, build things for the future. So it has been a challenging period, and January can always be a bit of a strange month. I don't think January is the month that you gauge the whole year by, because it's quite strange. It's quite slow to start with. People aren't back into routines and things like that. But yeah, we're busy, which is good. So yeah, if we're busy, we're happy.
Speaking of January being strange, we are kind of in the middle of the wassail season as well, which is a lovely Somerset tradition. Is that something you get involved with? Do you have a local wassail or one that you kind of go to a lot?
Yeah, I went to Martin Thatcher's on Friday night to the wassail, and I always really enjoy it because, I mean, it's a great business, the Thatcher business, fantastic products, and it's been really nice to see it sort of grow over the years. And there's a lot of parallels between a lot of those sort of Somerset food businesses, and there's a lot of similarities. So it's nice for me to see those things. And those Somerset traditions are really important parts of what makes up the sort of fabric of the community, and also really important stories behind the food that we all produce. So I think it's really important that we keep hold of those sort of traditions and cultural things.
Have you set yourself any resolutions, any personal goals for the year?
Yeah, I have again. I've not done very well. Every year I say I'm going to try and lose weight and I'm going to try and, you know, get fit. So this year I'm really determined to get fit and, you know, play some more sport and that sort of stuff.
Any particular methodology you're using?
I'm just trying to cut out calories. The old calorie management and sugar, carbs are my weakness, you know. I do love, I do like sweet things as well. So they've had to go, and I've cut my drinking back a bit as well.
Yeah. Yes, I have been back at the gym as well, trying to get rid of the Christmas extravagance that's going on.
Yeah, it's tough, but it's necessary, especially as I get older. I find it, you know, a bit tougher.
Rich, you represent the third generation of the Clothier family and as cheesemakers, but the family history goes back in the farming world beyond that as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, the family have been making cheese for hundreds of years. I mean, years ago, every farm in Somerset probably made cheese. So the family have been making cheese for hundreds of years. We've traced the recipe back several hundred years to one of my great-great-grandfathers who was delivering his cheese in Shepton Mallet, and a cheese dropped off the back of the cart, or the thief. There's some court notes that go with it. We found it in the court notes, and it says and it details the prosecution of the cheese thief. And the cheese thief says that the cheese fell off the back of the cart and actually gets away with it, but he actually took it off the back of the cart. And so it's quite nice to, we have done quite a bit of research on the family history. Mm. And it's quite nice to see those stories of cheese making in the past, yeah, and years gone by.
I wonder if that's the first time that that excuse was made. Is that where the saying comes from?
Do you think the guy made it up? Yeah, that's, could have been.
Yeah, maybe.
It just shows that the cheese doesn't really change after all that time and all of the excuses.
Is it true that your grandfather was born in a cheese room?
Yeah, well, my gran used to make the cheese. And my grandfather did a lot of the farming, and in those days the ladies made the cheese and did the dairy work, and the men would do the heavier labouring up out on the farm, and my grandmother made cheese right up to when my great grandmother, right up to when my grandfather was born. So he was born, she couldn't leave the vat because, you know, obviously if it's setting, you know, it needs to be cut and everything, you know. So she was there, right, and gave birth actually in the cheese room because she didn't want to leave the cheese. So I think that's taking it a little bit too far, maybe.
You probably wouldn't have any of your staff
never be allowed nowadays.
You mentioned it was more the women in the family who were sort of very much involved in the cheese making. It's your grandmother Ivy who's, yes, responsible, who's kind of not necessarily the creator of the recipe, but maybe the first person to bring it to one place in as a business. Is that the,
yeah,
story?
I think until that point, I think cheese was, in those days, cheese was very much viewed as a way of preserving milk over the winter. So it was about preserving food that you could eat over the winter, and then maybe that you could eat into the next season. So cheese was very rarely more than sort of a year old, because, you know, obviously they needed something to eat. You know, it was people were very poor and they were quite hungry, and so that was a way of preserving food into the winter. And she was the one who changed the mindset, because she changed it from, we're preserving milk, into something solid, to we're crafting something that should be really, taste really nice and be the same every time. So she was the first person to write the recipe down and say, right, we do make cheese and we're turning milk into something solid and preserving it, but we're all going to do it the same way every day. And these are the sort of critical points within the process. And she was probably the first sort of food technologist in the sort of family. And I think that's something that really stood the business in a really strong position for years to come, because that focus on quality and repeatability that she had set us apart from probably, you know, the thousands of cheesemakers that there were in Somerset at the time. So she was instrumental in changing the mindset about the way that the cheese was made.
What were your grandparents like as people? What do you remember about them?
Well, my gran was just a fantastic cook, you know, and I think that's why she sort of stamped her control on the sort of cheese making and the recipe and getting everyone else to do the same, because she made fantastic shortbread, she made fantastic cakes, she baked her own bread, and everything she did, you know, really properly, the best way that she could. And they were both very, very sort of proud and very, I wouldn't say self-aware, but very, very respectful. And also, I mean, my grandfather, for example, even working on the farm, he would look smart and they would dress smartly, you know, for making cheese. And I think they were part of a generation that upheld standards in everything that they did. And I think that's something that's probably rubbed off on, you know, the whole family. You know, it's about, you know, doing the best you can every day. And I think that's really, and that was certainly, my grandfather was very ambitious as well. You know, he was quite entrepreneurial, and she was very fastidious. And I think because of that, they were a really good partnership, because he was quite sort of, in many ways, quite flamboyant and, you know, looking to do new things and new opportunities. And she was very, she was what you would call a really good manager and a good technical manager and a good manager of people, because she was sort of like the boss. She's not only she did she make the cheese, but she used to feed everyone, and everyone who worked on the farm would sort of eat at the farmhouse. And she was, you know, she was a strong lady, but polite and strong. And you know, and when we hit, when I always hear about, you know, current generations inventing girl power and that sort of thing, I always think, you know, the ladies of Somerset were running farms, running businesses back at the turn of the, you know, the century before last, you know. So, you know, girl power was very active in Somerset, you know, hundreds of years ago. So, and she was typical of a lot of, you know, farmers' wives, you know, running farms, making products, managing people, and that was just the way it was.
Yeah. Have you seen those books which are sort of the little people, big stories or big ambitions and that kind of thing? My girls have one, which is like Great Women Who Changed the World. And it is, it's full of maybe people with a bit more public profile, but maybe, you know, maybe maybe I should get one of those.
Yeah, that would be
her,
great.
Have her story.
Yeah, I think so. And I think she sort of typified what Somerset was about in those, you know, in those days. Yeah, especially after the war when food was really short. And, you know, I think as they sort of grew up more after the war, they would have been more appreciative of the, you know, the small things in life. And also they're really, they were really frugal as well. I can remember, you know, they didn't waste anything. You know, we think nowadays that we're inventing, we think we're inventing recycling and sustainability. All we're doing is re-engaging with what they did when they were younger. You know, she recycled everything. My grandfather recycled and repaired everything. And, you know, their attitude to life was, you know, if you look after nature, nature will look after you. Because in the period before the Second World War and after, you know, if nature failed, you know, they'd lose, you know, people would starve and they would lose their living and their food, and, you know, they lived here. So they were very engaged with nature and very, very respectful of nature as well.
How about you? Did you enjoy growing up around and on a farm?
Yeah, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And, you know, I enjoyed playing on the farm with my cousins and my brother, and in a way that, you know, is, you know, is less, is, you're not let, you can't do that quite the same nowadays. I mean, it's, you know, things have, you know, health and safety, and quite understandably, you know, some of the things we did, I'm surprised that we're still here, you know. It's but it's, you know, it's part of growing up on a farm, and it was really nice to have a, you know, an outdoor lifestyle, and I still you know, I really enjoy that. And I think it's something that I think we probably want for all of our families, you know, to enjoy nature, and whether that's walking the dog or just, you know, enjoying, you know, the sunrise in the morning and the change in the seasons. You know, if you live in the country, you engage with and appreciate the change in the seasons in a way maybe that you don't in the city, because things stay the same more, but everything changes around you all year round.
Yeah, I was talking with someone, I think back in autumn, and we were talking about how spring and autumn as seasons, because there is more change and more kind of, that you can see more, you can kind of identify and connect with the changes that are going on in a more tangible way. And it was that sort of, well, it reminds you that this has happened for millions of years, the seasons have changed, and it will continue to change long after we're gone as well. So there's a nice ability to connect with nature, but also be reminded of how, you know, how small we are.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah, and I think and that's the great thing about coming into spring like we are now. You know, we're full of hope for the year ahead, and, you know, the harvest, and it's, there's something nice about that. I think it's that sort of recharging and regeneration time, so it's good.
What kind of jobs did you get given at the early age?
My brother and I, my dad loved being a pig farmer as well as cheese making. So when we were younger, we started working on the pig farm. I think I started working there when I was about 11 in the holidays and that sort of thing, and which I really enjoyed because, you know, the freedom of working with a load of other sort of people, you know, on a farm. And in those days, they would just expect you to do what everyone else did. So you get the freedom to sort of, you know, drive a tractor occasionally, or you know use high pressure equipment and this sort of thing, pressure washers and stuff, which is good. And it was good grounding. And then Tom and I both started making cheese when we were quite young as well. And I feel quite privileged to have made cheese before we had any of the sort of mechanisation that we've got now. So it gives you the chance to see it both ways, you know, and I quite enjoyed that. It was hard work, but I really did enjoy making cheese when I was younger.
Obviously, as we sort of mentioned earlier, your family's been in the area for hundreds of years. And in farming, it's often the case that you've got families living and working together in close proximity. And for many other families outside of agriculture, that's not the case. You know, you've got people who, they live in different places, they do completely different careers. You talked about playing with your cousins who, you know, are now still involved in the business. What effect do you think that has when you live with your family, you work with your family, you do everything together? How would you explain that to someone who doesn't have that as their reality?
I think that I feel very privileged to work. I'm really close to my older brother, Tom, and, you know, we've sort of grown up together. We work really closely together. My cousins, you know, run the farm inside the business and do a fantastic job. And I see them sort of less often. I see Tom every day almost, you know, and we work together a lot. And Dad's probably less involved now than he was before. He comes in every now and again and grates some cheese and stuff. But I think it's a real pleasure to work with family members and, you know, the people that you have that sort of bond with. But then at the same time, most of the team that I work with, we've worked together for, I think I saw some data the other day that Jen gave me, that something like 90% of the people we work with have been with us for over 10 years. So, you know, it sounds a bit of a cliche when you say everyone's part of the family, but when you've grown up with these people and you've worked with them since you were 20 years old or whatever, they are like part of the family, you know. And I think that's a really important thing in business. And someone once said to me years and years ago, to collect people through your career. And it was someone who was really successful as managing a PLC. And he said that he'd taken a group of people with him on the journey. And I think that's a really important thing, whether it's a family business or any other type of business, to collect really good people along the way and, you know, and grow with them.
You were at school just down the road as well.
Yes.
What were you like at school?
A bit wayward at times, you know, but I mean, I tried academically, great, no issues at all. But I was a little bit wayward outside of lessons. And I think that my grandfather used to say, and I try and remember this with my own children, he always says to me, he used to say to me, you can take the spirit out of a horse, but you can't put it back in. And I know I always think that some of the sort of rebels that I went to school with have been the most sort of successful people. So, you know, a bit of spirit doesn't hurt. I mean, obviously you need lines and boundaries and stuff. But yeah, no, I was pretty good at school, really. And I quite enjoyed it as well, really. So,
did you know that you would be continuing the family business? Or was there ever a point where your parents, your family said to you, if you want to do something else, that's an option?
I don't think they ever said, oh, you have to do it or anything like that. And I didn't really think about it, really. I think that Tom and I had worked together and we were just sort of involved in sort of projects and it just sort of happened, you know. But it wasn't something that I, you know, said, oh, that's definitely what I want to do. I think that I was always really enthused by, you know, what we're doing and what we're trying to do. And I was really lucky as well, because I I became more active in the business when we were just starting to sell into multiple retailers, and that sort of suited me. And every day that I've got, I was talking to Tom this morning, my brother, I'm really, really close to. We were talking about what we're going to do for the year ahead. And, you know, it's always really nice to have projects for the year ahead and everyone, you know what they're going to do. And I do, I am excited when I get up and, you know, and I do my work. I am excited by it. And I think that is a privilege, whatever you do. And I think that, I think when you stop being excited by it, that's when you need to find something else to do. And the time flies when you're excited as well. You know, 10 years has just flown by. It's crazy.
So let's talk about cheese, shall we?
Yeah, no, that sounds good. I'm obsessed with cheese. So all sorts of cheese, not just cheddar. I love cheese.
Well, let's start with cheddar and see where else we get to. Because, so cheddar is by far the most popular cheese in the UK, if not the world. According to my Wikipedia research, it makes up over half of the cheese we eat. So unless you're a vegan and you're listening to this, you've probably got some cheddar in your fridge, right? Or wherever you keep your cheese.
Yeah, cheese touches everyone's life. I was at a supermarket conference a couple of years ago, and there was someone from, I think it was Nielsen or one of those data companies, and they said that 99.8% of the population buy cheddar, and that's actually 1% higher than the number of people that buy loo rolls, which was quite an eye-opener. So I was quite shocked by that.
I don't really understand.
Well, I think some people get loo rolls from work and stuff.
Okay, right.
Whereas people buy cheese.
Yeah.
So, but I was quite impressed with that stat.
Is there anything about cheddar in particular, in its history or otherwise, that you think is the key to its popularity that's made it such a dominant cheese in what we consume?
I think there's a load of, aside from the, you know, if you address the practical things to start with, cheddar is a very stable food product. It keeps really well, you know, on some of the export cheddar that we sell, we put a year's life on it, it just gets better with age. So it is very convenient. You just get out of the cupboard, eat it, or, you know, so it's very convenient and easy to store and nutritionally dense. So from a technical point of view, it has a load of benefits. But most importantly, I think people just love the flavour and the versatility. You know, you can use it. Our vintage cheddar, people use it in the same way that they use in the export market. They use it in the same way that they use Parmesan because it has a lot of the, you know, similar sort of flavour notes. It's quite sweet, nutty, and, you know, creamy. And but it's got a better functionality than Parmesan as well, so it creams nicer and that sort of thing. So there's a load of practical reasons, but I think part of the thing that makes it good is the variety of it as well. You know, it's like wine. What makes it interesting is that, you know, I think my cheddar's the best in the world, but if you go to a, you know, a farm a couple of miles down the road, that family will think their cheddar's the best in the world. But one thing that you can't dispute is that they're all good cheeses, and that they are all different, and that variety is what makes the cheddar category so exciting, in the same way the wine category is.
So outside of your own, obviously, what are the sort of characteristics in a good cheddar that you look for?
I'm bound to say this, but I think the true home of cheddar is Somerset. I always think that, you know, cheddar should be made in the region where it, you know, where it came from, and I think that it's and I like a cheddar that's made from traditional starters, because I think you can taste that roundness of flavour and complexity that you don't get in cheddars that are made using, you know, artificial starters. And I think that is really important, because you get a completely different depth of flavour. So that's what I always look for. And I don't mind a, you know, a mild sort of cheddar, but I really do like a vintage cheddar, because I think it's the best articulation of what we all do, I think.
And we are, what, 10, 12 miles from Jeddah here, is that about
right? Yeah, you're about 10 miles as the crow flies. So, yeah, we're not far from... And you only have to look out the window today as well. You know, we're in, you know, mid-January. The weather's been appalling. The sun's just come out and the grass looks like it wants to grow. So it's an area that grass grows naturally, and good grass is the key to making good cheese. Yeah.
Talk me through the actual process, because obviously, you know, although it is such a familiar product to us, I think, again, most people, however big a cheese fan you are, don't always know from, you know, from grass to cheese, what's the actual kind of process.
I mean, the really important thing is it takes 10 litres of milk to make a kilo of cheddar. So you do need the quality of the milk. You know, the farmers, we work really hard on our own farm, but also we work hard with the farmers that supply us to make sure that the right type of milk comes into the dairy to make cheese, because you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. It has to be, you know, it has to be the right milk that comes in the first place. And then we spend a lot of time nurturing the starter bacteria, which develop the flavour. So we make our own starters here on site, and we culture the bacteria over and over again so that the same starters are used all the time. And that's the bacteria that drives the flavour in the cheese. And those are really important things for me, attention to detail throughout the whole process, how the curd sets in the vat, and you know how we press the whey out of it, and how the acidity develops in the cheese throughout the whole maturing process. So it's a long job. When we make a vintage cheddar, it's a two-year job every day all the way through. So we monitor the cheese all the way through until it goes to the shopper wherever they are around the world.
You mentioned kind of the other manufacturers, other providers, of which there are dozens within a stone's throw. What's the sort of relationship like? Is there a healthy rivalry, or is there sort of, you don't talk to each other in the pub?
No, there's a healthy rivalry, and also there's a respect as well, because if you're a family business like ours, and you've made it through this far, you know, when I was a child, I went to a meeting with my dad, a farmhouse cheesemakers meeting at one of the local pubs. I think it was at Lidford or somewhere like that, when I was, you know, I was probably only three or four. And there was about 50 of us in the room, you know, just from the local area. Now there's only about three or four of us left in that area. And my dad said that when he was younger, and he said there was thousands of them. And I think that, you know, you don't end up being one of the ones that's left unless, you know, the cheese is good and worth eating and has a good story and good provenance. And I think that's what people appreciate about cheddar, or, you know, wherever they eat it around the world. The fact that it's really nice, lovely food product, but also the provenance and the story behind it, and the story of the families and the farms in Somerset. And it is a lovely place to produce food. I think it's no accident that we have so many nice food brands from the Southwest. I think the Southwest knows food, doesn't it, I think?
It does. And I think the point that you made about provenance and the stories and people wanting to know more about what they're eating, it seems really obvious that you should care about what you're putting in your body, but it also seems really surprising that that's only really been something that has become mainstream in the last, you know, 5-10 years, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's another thing I think that's lost. You've been lost through the generations, because my grandfather used to say that he would never buy milk from a farm where he wouldn't stop and have a cup of tea in the kitchen, you know. So that was his sort of technical way of saying, well, you know, if the kitchen in the farmhouse is sort of dirty and you wouldn't stop for a cup of tea, you wouldn't buy the milk. And I think in those days, he would never buy a cow from someone he didn't know, or, you know, everything they bought came from someone that they knew the provenance of it. And in the same as their approach to provenance and their approach to sustainability was very much how people are trying to re-engage with food now. Mm. You know, people do want to know who's prepared the food. They do want to know where it's made and how it's made, how the cows were treated or how the animals were treated. And I think that was something that was lost in that sort of packaged food supermarket era that everyone thought was a lot better in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And I think people are now trying to re-engage with the people that produce food with them, for them, I think.
The outcome of that period, the sort of mass supermarketization, that's not a word, is it?
It's a good word. It works.
The journey from, you know, everyone but knowing where their cheese comes from to buying it at a supermarket at whatever lowest cost they can.
Yeah.
You know, the outcome of that has been a really cheap, really efficient supermarket industry, but at quite a significant cost.
I think there's some things we take for granted in the UK as well. The UK is well legislated. The food quality is very, very high at, you know, all levels. And you know, when we talk to customers in the export market, they do appreciate that. They know that when they buy British, it is produced to the highest standards in the world. But I think increasingly, as we see more imported foodstuffs from, you know, the US, not that the US food is bad particularly, but when you get outside of the UK sort of regulatory field, you know, people are producing food to different standards. And, you know, a lot of people that doesn't matter to, but it's just nice to know. And I like to know what I'm eating and where it's come from and how it's produced.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be a while before anyone's raving about American cheese.
I certainly hope so. Hopefully it's the other way around. We sell a bit in the States, not a huge amount.
You know, they can kind of get involved in the wine market, that's fine.
Yeah,
but, you know, don't taste the cheese.
My French colleagues would not agree with you on the wine. They say, oh no, all the wine has to come from France.
As MD, how much of your role is focused on the product versus other areas of the business? How do you generally sort of split your time?
I talk about cheese all the time, you know, so the focus of the business has to be producing the best cheese we can every day. And that's the sort of bedrock. But yeah, I spend a lot of my time talking to customers and talking to people about cheese. And that's, you know, my job as much as anything else is, you know, is telling the story of the business and talking about the cheese and helping to sell cheese, but at the same time trying to help forge a strategy for the year ahead. You know, we talk about earlier on about what we want to do for the year ahead, and, you know, we want to produce more cheese to, you know, higher environmental standards and, you know, minimize the impact on the environment and everything else. And we want to sell to more people in the world in more regions. So, and that's my job.
You've obviously grown the company, so it's vastly different from what it was when you were a kid. Mm. Is keeping the family DNA difficult the bigger you get?
I don't think it is. I think the family just gets bigger in terms of it's really important to have the right mix of family and non-family members and people you can rely on, especially as the business gets bigger, because it's not the business that, you know, Tom and I joined when we were younger. It's you know, I think one day last week, In one day, I think we turned over something like £2 million in a day. And, you know, the scale of the business and the responsibility for the people that we work with and everything else has changed. But at the same time, it doesn't mean you can't retain those family business values at the same time as working with a load of really professional people on finance, technical, health and safety, environmental and all the other stuff. And I think that if you keep that blend of family and, you know, outside, I don't mean that in a derogatory way, outside professionals, and I think you can get a really, really exciting mix and a really, really good business that you wouldn't necessarily get from a PLC or something like that on its own.
And when you are looking to bring in those skills that don't exist within your family, within your network, how much importance do you place on the values that those people are bringing to the table as well as their professional skills?
I think, you know, in terms of being able to work as part of a team and be reactive, I like to think that, you know, a couple of the things that family businesses do better than some other businesses, we're long-term about the decisions we make. We're not just looking at the next year end or, you know, 3 or 5 years' time. We make generational decisions, but also we make decisions quickly as well. You know, I like to think that family businesses can afford to be brave and make decisions really quickly. And that can be a cultural change for people that have worked in much, much bigger businesses that aren't sort of family run and things like that. So everyone has their different skill set, and it's important to get the right blend of skills and attitudes and everything else.
You talked about making decisions sort of at a generational level. Obviously, you've got, you know, a long time to go, but at what point do you start thinking about the next generation for Wyke Farms and the legacy that you want to leave, but also what happens with the next generation of the family?
Well, I think that, I don't have any sort of intention of sort of retiring or anything else. And I think that it's really important to sort of stay active. But I think that you know, it's nice to have younger people coming into the business, whether they're family members or, you know, or anyone else. Yeah, and I think that is a really important thing. And it's probably one of the things that, you know, worries me quite a bit is that on the cheese making side and the processing side, there's a lot of people that Tom and I started working with when we were younger. And you think, well, you know, in 20 years' time, everyone's going to sort of be retiring together. So it is really important to keep younger people coming in and coming up through the business. And it's something we've tried to encourage within the business. But at the same time, you want people coming in who've got the passion and drive for the business that we all have.
You talked a lot earlier about, you know, how you and Tom were kind of making cheese from a very young age, and also, you know, running about on the farm doing things which health and safety would probably not allow these days. How do you involve your family in some of the processes and in the heritage, but at the same time kind of being aware of the fact that standards have changed and the idea of, you know, kids making cheese is not really something that we want happening?
No, it's a difficult balance, and I think that all you can do is, you know, sometimes they sort of come cheese grading, try some cheese. One of my daughters is doing an accountancy sort of apprenticeship with the business at the moment, and I think that's all you can do, sort of give them a taste of the business or whatever. But opportunities for young people are sort of far and wide, aren't they? You know, a lot of the family might not want to make cheese or whatever, but I think what the business has to have is a solid management team that can run the business tomorrow. You know, if I was run over walking out of the building here, I can absolutely hand on heart say there's a really competent management team that can keep the business going and nothing changes. And I think, you know, we might all have plans for 20 years' time or 30 years' time, whatever, but it's the sort of here and now and tomorrow and everything else that counts. So the team has to be competent every day of its working life, and it can't be overly reliant on one person in any area. And that's what we've tried to do, build a team that can exist on its own and, you know, whatever else happens, happens, doesn't it?
Obviously, we can't talk about the future of farming and cheese making without covering the environment. So can you talk to me a little bit about the philosophy that sort of runs through all of the different elements of sustainability and impacts that you have here?
environmental sustainability and financial sustainability, I think, go hand in hand. I've not seen an instance yet where, you know, if you do something to, every time I think you do something to lower carbon or lower emissions, I think it has a positive impact on cost. So I think the two do go hand in hand. And when my grandparents used to say, you know, if you look after nature, nature will look after you. If you invest in the fabric of the countryside and the environment, it does stand you in good stead. I mean, probably the clearest example of that is renewable energy systems that we've developed have insulated us slightly over the last year or so in terms of these sort of crazy energy prices. And I think one of the things people miss about sustainability is it quite often goes hand in hand with self-sufficiency as well, because if you're more sustainable, you make and reuse the things that the business requires, then it makes you more independent from outside sources and supply chains. So the sustainability philosophy of the business is that it's not optional. It isn't optional. We have to make cheese and farm in a way that has a minimal impact on the countryside and the environment. And that's the mission for the business to... And the only way that we can judge that is for our strive to create a net positive business, which for me is simple to explain. And, you know, you don't need pages and pages of mission statements or anything else. Net positive for me means the environment, the community and everything else has to be better for having the business here than it would be if we were taken away. And that's quite an easy way to measure any business, whether that's the Wyke business or one of our farmer suppliers or anyone who exists in the community. Is the community better for having you there? Is the environment better for having you there? And I think that's something we all should strive for as businesses and individuals.
How do you feel that compares with maybe other businesses that aren't as ingrained into the natural environment and farming? So, you know, when you're at food conferences or retailer conferences and you're talking with people who are in similar roles to you but aren't necessarily in the environment around them, they're maybe kind of a few steps away from the kind of production and the natural side of it. How do you find that contrast? Is it something that they're catching up with?
I think it's a buzzword in business, isn't it, now, I think. But in, you know, people talk a lot about investing in natural capital and all that sort of stuff. But I think as farmers, you can sense the natural capital improvements. You know, when you walk around the countryside and the farm and everything else, you can see the difference that's being made. And, you know, and I believe in climate change. You know, the climate is changing. Yeah, we might get the same amount of rain every month, but we get it all in half an hour now rather than spread over the whole month. So things have changed. You know, the climate has changed, whether people like it or not. And I think that if we're going to carry on farming and making food in this region, you know, in 100 years' time or 200 years' time, then we have to do something to redress that and tilt the balance. So I think it's a really, really important mission. And that's why we've engaged at every level, through from our farmers all the way through to the customers. And I think we live in a fantastic age where, you know, science and technology are there in a way they were never before to allow us to drive those improvements.
You talked about how it's sort of a buzzword. There are different ways in which some people will say this is how we are, you know, looking to achieve maybe a different kind of net zero to what your net zero looks like. And sometimes that sort of offsetting or we'll do this carbon capture thing in the future. And it's like, well, actually, the natural world has some very good carbon capture things that have been working for millions of years. And rather than relying on that sort of technology that isn't necessarily there yet, what we should be doing is thinking about how we can achieve that net zero in a more kind of balanced way, in a more equilibrious way with the world around us. Yeah. Was that a question? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think that it comes back to that net positive in all that you do. And I think one of the clearest examples of that is when you see these companies with, you know, fantastic 10-year vision for how they're going to minimize their environmental impact, and then they fire half their staff by text message. You know, it's not walking the walk that they've laid out, you know, and you can, and that's the thing that makes me a bit sad, you know, about some of the way that the big companies behave is that they do it because they're, you know, they're going through the motions because their shareholders or whatever might have said that's what they want them to do. But I'm not sure they truly believe in it. And I think that as a family business, we genuinely believe in it. And that's what we want to do. And I think that's part of the longer term view of things, and certainly everything that we've invested in our business to minimize impact has also been good for the business commercially. So I have nothing but positive experiences to sort of hand on to people about.
If those decisions and if those investments that you've made, you know, you have that proof point that says, look, we're having this positive impact and we're also generating more revenue, more profit, we're becoming more efficient as a business. What is it that's stopping others from doing the same things that you are?
I think in the farming sector, I think it's lack of government support, not just financial support, but clarity in policy. And I think that a lot of farmers want to do much, much more in terms of green energy production, anaerobic digestion on farms. You know, farmers, something like 98% of farm waste never goes through an anaerobic digester. It's spread on land and everything else. And farmers really could be part of the long-term energy solution with anaerobic digesters on farms producing, you know, gas back into grid or electrical energy. But it can only be achieved by government creating, recognising the opportunity and helping farmers to create the right conditions on farm for that to happen. Because farmers, by their very nature, are quite risk averse. They don't want to take risks. You know, they plant crops today and they harvest them in, you know, 6 months' time or whatever. So they don't really want to take risks, and that's where government has to sort of help unlock that potential, because there's a huge amount of potential there. I mean, just to give you one stat, if you put an anaerobic digester on the average dairy farm, it cuts its carbon footprint by a third. Now, you imagine if you could cut the carbon footprint of British dairying by a third. It's a fantastic win. And there aren't many single issues that you could throw onto a farm and cut the emissions by a third, and that's one of them.
So why isn't that happening?
Because I'm not sure the government understands the potential that's there on farm. And also, I think the NFU do a good job of trying to communicate what British farming does and what British food does. But I think when you have a London-centric government, it's just not as sexy as, you know, financial trading from Canary Wharf or whatever. And that's the challenge for us as farmers and food producers, to make it, you know, get that message across and show them what the potential there is.
Yes, that's a tricky thing.
That is a tricky thing to do.
Outside of the UK, then, when you are talking about this side of the business, how is it received? Obviously, you know, we know in the UK that it's very of the moment, it's something that people want to talk about. But elsewhere in the world, where else is kind of really, really hot on this stuff?
I struggle to find anywhere that it isn't topical, I think. It's very topical in Europe. It's very topical in the US, but only amongst a certain section of the buying public. So the US tends to be quite polarised around the issue. In the Asian markets, it's really, really topical, incredibly topical, far more so than it is in the UK. So when you go into those Asian markets, one of the first things they ask us is, you know, what you're doing about your emissions and your environmental impact. It's one of the first, you know, once we've tried the cheese and they like the cheese, it's almost the next question straight away. So it's really, and it's an area where the UK can do very well, because we do, our dairy farmers in the UK have some of the lowest carbon footprints in the world. So it's an area we can excel at.
Looking back at all you've done and forward at everything else to come, what advice do you think Grandmother Ivy would give you regarding the history of white farms and what's going to happen next?
Well, I think her advice was always the same. It was about, you know, making the cheese the best way that you can, and making it in a way that you can be proud of. And she was, and that was very much her, one of the things she always would say is that when you go to bed at night, you've got to look back and be proud of what you've done and be proud of the way that you've done it. And I think that's a really, really good piece of advice that you can give people in any job, in any part of the world, I think.
Rich, we're now going to play Somerset Address or Obscure Movie Title.
Yes.
It doesn't have a catchy name.
No.
But it's the game where I give you a name and you have to decide whether it's a place in Somerset or a movie that I have picked out from a long list of movies that you probably haven't seen.
Probably not.
Are you a big movie fan?
Yeah, I quite like movies. Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you have seen any of these, I'll be impressed. So I'll give you the name, and
yes,
then you'll tell me what you think. So the first is Hyena Road.
I reckon that's a movie.
It is a movie. It's a war drama from 2015.
Is it?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Not seen it.
Yeah.
So
not a blockbuster. That
good.
One, then.
Good start. The Incline.
I think that's a location.
It is a location. You don't get extra points, but would you want to guess where it is, where it might be, nearest town?
Well, I reckon the Incline is probably, it's in Somerset, obviously.
Yeah.
I would say somewhere like Brent Knoll.
It's Ilminster, so right direction.
Yeah.
A little bit
better.
All right, next one is Zigzag.
Oh, that's a hill.
It is.
That's a location.
It's in Clevedon.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's, yes.
There might be more.
Yes.
There might be more Zigzags, but the one I've got is in Clevedon. Awkward Hill.
I reckon that sounds like one of those Vietnam War movies. I'm going to go movie, I reckon.
It's not a movie, it's another place.
Oh, is it?
It's up in Blagdon. Awkward Hill.
Awkward Hill.
So that's the first one you got wrong.
Ah, oh, no, we were on for 100% then.
The next one is The Onion Field.
I reckon that's a movie.
It is a movie. It's a 1979 crime drama.
Oh, shit.
With Ted Danson and James Woods.
Ted Danson. Excellent.
So, I don't know if
I'll
it's any good.
I'll search for that later on Netflix.
Add it to the list.
Is it on Netflix or?
I mean,
probably
it might
not.
Be. It might be. Your next title / place, Come Away Home.
That could be one of that. That sounds like Somerset language.
It does, doesn't it?
I'm going to go for a location on that.
Well, I've thrown you a curveball. It's actually a movie.
Oh, is it?
It's a from 2005 TV movie.
It sounded like Somerset language.
It does,
I
a little
thought,
bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why it's in.
Was it
in
made
the
in Somerset? Come Away.
No, it's a US TV movie. One of those Hallmark Channel things. So you've got two more. Salmon Parade.
Salmon Parade has to be a location.
It is a location. It's in Taunton.
Oh.
And your last one is Waffle Street.
Waffle Street. This could be the trick question. So I'm going to go for film.
It is a film. Yeah. It's a comedy from 2015 where a banker decides to go and work in a diner.
Excellent.
Great plot.
Sounds
you know,
good.
They'll make films about anything these days,
yeah,
won't
they? Will.
So you got six out of eight.
Excellent. Six out of eight. That's not bad.
Pretty good.
We'll go for that.
Rich, thank you so much for your time. It's been great getting to know you and hearing your story. Before we go, where can people find out more about what it is that you guys are up to here?
I mean, if you go onto the website, on www.whitefarms.com, or look at any of our social channels. You know, there's loads of videos, etc., on Instagram, or follow us on Facebook. You know, we keep putting regular updates on there about what we do.
And you've got visitor centre here as well. You do tours and stuff.
We do tours of the green energy plant as well. So if you've got a group that would like to come and see, you know, sustainability and have a look around, then we can arrange tours. And we've got a farm shop here on site as well.
Rich, it's been great. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Lewis. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Somerset Stories is a Whitstone production, and music is provided by Jazzar under Creative Commons.